Hello and welcome. This is Emphasis Added, a podcast by the Houston Law Review about legal issues, prominent lawyers, and obscure blue book rules. I'm your host, Drew Padley, editor-in-chief of the Houston Law Review. Before we begin, I want to take a moment to thank our sponsor, Vinson & Elkins, a global law firm with 13 offices and more than 750 lawyers committed to excellence in serving its sophisticated clients in industries such as energy, finance, technology, real estate, media, and beyond. V&E hires the best and brightest law students and lawyers, valuing diverse perspectives and backgrounds. Visit www.velaw.com to learn more about V&E's summer associate program and hiring opportunities. Start your success story at Vinson & Elkins. Today on the show, we have United States District Court Judge for the Southern District of Texas, Judge Vanessa Gilmore. Before serving as a federal judge, she graduated from the University of Houston Law Center, worked for 13 years at a Houston law firm where she specialized in civil litigation, and served in such public roles as chairperson for the Texas Department of Commerce Policy Board and chairperson for Texans for NAFTA. In 1994, Judge Gilmore was nominated to the federal bench by President Clinton. Judge Gilmore, thank you for joining us and welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me.
Yeah, we really appreciate you coming on and taking the time out to tell us a little bit about your story. So can you tell us a little bit about where you grew up and what your childhood was like?
I was a child of a man who was in the military. I was an Army brat. And we spent a number of years living in Okinawa, where my father was stationed. We moved back to the United States in 1965, and my parents were both working at Walter Reed Army Medical Center in Washington, D.C. And we lived in a suburb of Washington in Silver Spring, Maryland. And so I grew up finishing elementary school and junior high school and high school in Silver Spring while my parents were working in Washington, D.C. And I stayed there until I left for college in 1973.
And when you went to college in 1973, you went to Hampton University, correct?
I went to Hampton University in Hampton, Virginia, which was known at the time as Hampton Institute. And it was a historically black college in Virginia. And it was a very good experience for me to attend Hampton.
So then after you graduated from Hampton, you eventually made your way to law school, but in between, I think you had a career. Is that correct?
I did. And when I was in undergraduate school, I was majoring in clothing and textiles and marketing with a singular focus to become a fashion buyer for a major department store. When I finished Hampton University in 1977, when I finished Hampton University in 1977, I moved to Houston to take a job as a fashion buyer at Foley's Department Store. I had previously worked during the summer some internships for major department stores in New York City, but decided instead of going back to New York after undergraduate school to venture west and come out to Houston and take a job as a fashion buyer at Foley's Department Store.
Now, I assume a fashion buyer is someone who selects and purchases the clothes that the department store will ultimately sell?
Yes, absolutely. That was the job. A lot of fun. Going to fashion shows, buying clothes, coming back, selling them.
Not so bad. And I read that at the time you were a fashion buyer, you got yourself involved in a legal dispute. And
with my apartment complex, which was an apartment complex that's actually still there today. It's called the Three Fountains Apartments out on Fountain View Drive. I was living out there. Out off of Westheimer Road, and I thought I was grown. I went to college when I was 16, so I ended up moving down here when I was 20 years old. But you couldn't have told me that I wasn't a complete grown up. So I went out of town one weekend without telling my parents where I was going, and those were in the days before cell phones and answering machines and pagers. And if you called somebody and they were on the phone, you got a busy signal. So it was sort of back in the stone tablet and chisel days. So my parents were looking for me one weekend, and they couldn't find me, so they asked the apartment people to go into my apartment and take a look around. So they did. And I had a hobby at the time. I was really into photography, and I had a lot of photography equipment, and I had a dark room in my apartment. And they went into the apartment and sort of helped themselves to all my photography equipment.
Oh, no.
So when I came back home, my door was unlocked and wide open, and all my stuff was gone. And my parents told me that they sent the people in to look around to see if I was okay. And I went to the manager and I said, hey, you know, you guys were in my apartment this weekend and y'all took my stuff. And they said, oh, no, you must have had a break-in. I said, there's no break-in. The door's unlocked. Mm-hmm. And so this friend of mine talked me into suing them under a theory called reciprocaloquitur. You know what that means? You remember?
It means that which doesn't need to be explained.
Exactly.
Or something speaks
the
for
itself. The thing speaks for itself.
Yes.
And so this friend of mine talked me into going to the law library and trying to find a theory. And the thing that spoke for itself was I had a key. They had a key. Somebody came in with a key. My stuff was gone. It was their fault. So I went to court, tried my little case, got my little money. I thought, hey, I think this is fun. I think I'm going to law school. So I hurried up, took the LSAT. Decided to go to law school at the University of Houston and entered law school in the fall of 1979.
And probably in the same building that we're at law school right now.
Same building, Bates 1 and Bates 2. Hasn't changed, has it?
No, not a job.
Not yet. No. We'll put it that way, right?
And then after law school, what was your time at law school like?
Terrible.
And was that the academics or the lifestyle or all of the above?
Well, let me just be honest. I started law school in 1979. It was sort of the first year that there had been a critical mass of women. The year that we started, there wasn't even a women's bathroom in the teaching units. They took a piece of paper and wrote women and taped it over the men's restroom sign. So our bathrooms had urinals in them. They weren't prepared for that influx of women coming into the law school at that point in time. Law school was challenging, as it is supposed to be, but for me, I'd led such a charmed life up until I was 22 years old, I guess, at that point. And as it turns out, interestingly, I had never had anybody actually discriminate against me in any way. And then I got to law school, and I got a grade that I knew I didn't deserve. Mm-hmm. And I went to talk to the professor about it. And he said, well, me and another young student, a Hispanic guy, and we went to go ask about our grades. And he told us that he had looked up our exam numbers and he had just decided that blacks and Mexicans couldn't write and that he was just going to give us whatever grade that he wanted to. And he didn't care what we actually did on the work. And so he gave me a grade that I felt like I did not deserve. But because I was so shocked by the experience, I did not have the wherewithal at that time to fight back and to push back. I was just really scared. And so I just kind of shrunk in and decided that I was going to make up for that experience and that grade by trying to show people that it was an anomaly and just work really hard and do extremely well in other classes so that I could show that that was an outlier for me. But it really caught me by surprise, and I was ill-prepared to deal with it. I should have probably gone to the administration, but I was too nervous and scared and just happy to be there, so I didn't do anything about it. But it set the tone for my entire experience in law school, because that was my very first semester of school. And so I just worked really hard to make sure that I got the grades that I felt like I deserved, and I was hoping that there would not be, you know, other professors who were doing the same thing, but I didn't have any way of knowing. That was my very first semester and one of my very first experiences. And so it just made me skeptical that I was going to be able to be evaluated and judged based on the work that I was actually putting out.
It sounds like you took a really terrible situation and used it to motivate you through the rest of school.
I mean, I was already a very motivated person, but I just decided that I was just going to have to really work extra hard to make sure that I got some decent grades to, you know, let people know about the level of work that I felt that I could do. And it worked out to my advantage. One of my other professors called me up at the end of the class and asked me, he was an adjunct professor, as a matter of fact, and he said, did you get the highest grade in my class? And I said, almost. I got the next to the highest. And he said, yeah, I knew you would. He said, so why don't you come work for me? And so, because he had a law firm already. And so that's what I ended up doing. I ended up going to work for him, I think as an intern, my last semester of law school. And then he offered me a job, and that's the law firm that I ended up going to work for right out of law school. So, you know, being motivated to do well and to show the work that I could do in other classes worked to my benefit, because it ultimately secured for me the job that I eventually went to right out of law school.
I think it's a great illustration of why it's important to remember that people are always watching you, and if you can take a small bit of responsibility that's right in front of you and do a really good job with it, then maybe some more opportunities will open
up. So you never know. Mm-hmm. You never know when people are looking at you, but you should assume that people are looking at you all of the time.
That's great advice. And actually, so shortly after you graduated, you were back at the Law Center as an adjunct professor as well, right?
I was teaching research and writing. I don't know how I let anybody talk me after that, but I did come back and teach a research and writing class at the University of Houston.
All right. So then about a decade into your law career, you were appointed to the Texas Department of Commerce Policy Board. And actually, it's a very important appointment. You were the first African-American to serve on the board. Can you speak a little bit about that organization and what your role was there?
So when Governor Ann Richards became governor of the state of Texas, one of the things that she had decided to do was to make sure that the boards and commissions of Texas were reflective of the population of Texas and looked like what Texas looked like, and that all of the important decisions that were being made for the state of Texas weren't going to be made by a monolithic body of people. And so she set about to find talent to run the boards and commissions of Texas, and asked me to Austin to interview me for a position on the board of the Texas Department of Commerce. I would not be honest if I didn't say that it caught me by surprise, because being a trial lawyer, being asked to come in and help with business development for the state of Texas, you know, did not seem to be a good match for me. But one of the things she said to me was that she had paid attention to the work that I was doing in the community, and that she saw that I had taken an agency or an organization that was floundering at the time, which was the YWCA of Houston, and that I had really turned that around because I'd spent a term as president of the YWCA of Houston. And that at the time, the Texas Department of Commerce was really under fire, and the Texas legislature was considering sunsetting or just completely eliminating the entire agency. And she said she needed somebody with a big mouth who wasn't afraid to take on a challenge, and that she was interested in me because she had heard that I was not the kind of person to hide my light under a bushel. Well, at the time, I didn't even really know what that meant, but that term actually comes from the Sermon on the Mount, and it means somebody who doesn't hide their talent or abilities. And I thought, yeah, that's me. I'm not the kind of person who hides my light under a bushel. And so I decided to take on the challenge of working to help restore confidence in the Texas Department of Commerce. And so I started that position in 1991, and that was the agency that was responsible for job training, tourism development, and business development for the state of Texas. During the time that I was on the Commerce Board, we worked on a number of initiatives to bring and develop business opportunities in the state of Texas, to bring a lot of new companies to the state of Texas. And also one of our biggest initiatives was working on the NAFTA treaty, the North American Free Trade Agreement. And then I became head of an organization as a result of my work on the board of the Texas Department of Commerce. I became head of an organization called Texans for NAFTA, and spent a lot of time going back and forth between the U.S. and Mexico, working on trade opportunities and issues involving trade, North American free trade, and actually worked quite a lot on initiatives to push the passage of the NAFTA treaty, and got to go to Washington for the signing of the NAFTA treaty at the time that that was actually signed into law. So it was a really exciting time. A lot of work, but that was just a volunteer opportunity. So that it was almost a full-time job working on the board of the Texas Department of Commerce, and I was still working full-time as a trial lawyer at the same time.
I had no idea. That sounded, yeah, like a full load.
That was not a job. That was a volunteer position. And so it was a lot of work, but it really was the thing that probably had the biggest influence in terms of me being able to have the opportunity to get to the federal bench eventually.
Okay. And just before we talk about the federal bench, I also heard that for this NAFTA position that you actually picked up Spanish in order to carry out your duties of the position.
I did. I don't know if I had already started working on my Spanish some years before I went on the board of the Texas Department of Commerce, but I found out that it was extremely helpful to have an understanding of Spanish and to be able to communicate in Spanish. When we spent a lot of time going back and forth between the U.S. and Mexico, there was one occasion where there's a big conference that was held every year during that time called the Border Governors Conference. And it's all the U.S. states and Mexican states that border each other. There are 10 altogether, and they meet every year at that time. They met every year to talk about cross-border issues. And so we would spend a lot of time preparing for that conference every year. And I remember the one year I was supposed to go, and the governor at the last minute had to pull out because it was the year of the Branch Davidian compound that happened up in Waco. And she was from Waco, so she had to go there. So I had to go to the Border Governors Conference as her representative. And so it was really a fun and interesting and exciting opportunity because I decided to give my speech, the speech that the governor would have normally given. I decided to give that speech in Spanish instead of in English, but I didn't tell anybody in advance. And so everybody has their headphones on, you know, The Mexicans have on their headphones to hear it in English, and the Americans have, you know, sitting there just waiting. And then everybody had to switch real fast because I started giving my speech in Spanish. And so that was really fun to be able to do that at that conference, which was a very important conference during that time because it really was the thing that helped us facilitate getting the NAFTA treaty passed.
It must have been quite a surprise for some people, but also very impressive. So now you're in the spotlight and you've done some public service for a few years at this point, despite it being unpaid public service. So what made you decide to switch to being a federal judge, or how did you even consider putting yourself out there for that?
I did not.
You didn't? Okay.
I did not. It was not an opportunity that I was looking for. I wasn't interested in it. I love being a trial lawyer. I love being in the community, doing public service work. Going on the federal bench was not on my list of things to do this lifetime, and I did not even apply for the opportunity. But in 1993, when President Clinton was elected, he decided to name Senator Lloyd Benson, who was our U.S. Senator, as Secretary of the Treasury. And that left an opening in the state for our U.S. Senator. The way that it worked at that time, the governor was to appoint the interim person to the to fill that position for that seat. And the man that she named was a gentleman by the name of Bob Krueger. He, at the time, was the chairperson of the Railroad Commission. The Railroad Commission is sort of a misnomer because it has to do with trucking, transportation, oil and gas, all things related to commerce in Texas. Well, he and I traveled together all of the time when we were working on recruiting businesses to the state of Texas. And so when he was named as the new U.S. Senator, I knew that there were about 10 vacancies on the federal bench in Texas because President Bush had not filled those vacancies, I think supposing that he was going to get a second term, which he didn't. And so I had actually gone to Senator Krueger and asked him if I could be on his committee to help select the federal judges. And he said, oh, yeah, you can do that. And so I decided I would do that. I really saw myself really more in the kingmaker role, not the king role. And so I showed up with the intent of working hard on that committee, as I had on many other public service opportunities. And my fellow committee members told me that they were asking for me to resign and not participate on the committee. I thought I had offended someone or done something that made somebody mad at some point in time. And I said, well, why? What did I do? And I was crying and it was just drama. And they said, oh, no, we're putting your name up. And I was like, no. I really was not particularly interested. I was still working really hard as a trial lawyer. I was making a lot of money. I was doing the work that I loved. I was doing volunteer work that I loved. I was very involved in politics. And all of that I saw going away as if I decided to take a position as a federal judge. But I went with one of the other guys that was on the committee, who was a good friend of mine, and we went and called my pastor, Reverend Bill Lawson. And I called Reverend Lawson and I said, "Reverend Lawson, something terrible has happened." He said, "What?" And I said, "They want me to be a federal judge." And I said, and he said, "What?" And he said, "Ask yourself two questions." He said, "Can you do a good job? Will it be good for the community?" And I said, "I can do a good job. I know I can." And he said, "Well, I think it would be good for the community for you to be there. I'm going to need you to call me back when you have a real problem." Click, and hung the phone up in my face.
Wow.
And I thought, wow, I couldn't believe it. Now, on the other hand, I called the governor, who was also a big mentor of mine, and told her about the opportunity that had been presented, and she told me not to do it. She told me she thought it was a horrible idea and that I was getting put out to pasture early and that she had plans for me and that she wasn't going to be able to fulfill those plans if I became a judge. And she told me that she had, in fact, decided to put me on the ballot with her and that she wanted me to run to be head of the Railroad Commission in Texas. And I thought, what? So I called my mother, third person, most important person, and I said, "Mom, you know, the governor thinks it's a terrible idea for me to become a federal judge. She wants me to run for the Railroad Commission." And my mother said, "I never heard you say you wanted to run for statewide office." She said, "If I'd ever heard you say you wanted to run for statewide office before, I would say go for it." She said, "But you know, sometimes you get on the fast train and you think you can pull the bell and get off whenever you feel like it, and you're on the fast train to somebody else's destiny." She said, "You better pull the bell and get off while you can." And so that really influenced me a lot. So I pulled the bell and I got off and I decided to go ahead and accept the opportunity to go to the federal bench. The governor went on to run in the election that she wanted me to run with her in against George W. Bush and got beat like she stole something. And that would have been me. I would have been on that ticket with her, which that was her destiny. That wasn't my destiny, you know, to end up on a losing ticket with the governor of Texas. So my destiny ended up being to go to the federal bench. And so I got nominated in 1993 and I got confirmed in 1994. And at the time that I got confirmed, I was the youngest sitting federal judge in the United States because I was 36 at the time that I was nominated. And I think I was almost 37 by the time that I was confirmed in 1994.
That's great. Youngest federal judge in the country. And at the time, I think you were the first University of Houston Law Center alum to sit on the federal bench as well.
I was. And then that school that didn't treat me so good, they were all over me. No, but it was all good. It was all good. The University of Houston was extremely supportive of me. And I actually ended up having my investiture ceremony at the University of Houston. I think that it was really a proud moment, not just for me and for my family, but it actually... probably was just a very proud moment for the university as well. So it was nice that that they were able to embrace that and embrace me in that way and make that a celebration for the entire law school.
It's an incredible achievement. Mm-hmm. So at that time now, you've become a federal judge and what was probably new back then, I mean, by now it's probably second nature to you. So can you tell us a little bit about how you approach cases that are before you, what your goal is, and just generally how you like to manage your courtroom?
Okay, that's about 50 questions all wrapped into one. And I guess maybe it would be helpful to talk about the kind of work that we do here that might help people understand, get a little bit of an understanding of the way that we approach things. So we're courts of limited jurisdiction, obviously. We only deal with cases arising under federal law, federal constitution, cases involving diverse citizens of different states, or cases involving citizens of the United States and people from other countries. So, you know, we don't have the same breadth of work that state judges would. That being said, we still do cover a lot of territory. On the civil side, we do employment discrimination. We do personal injury work. We do a lot of intellectual property here in Houston, patents, trademarks, and copyrights. We do admiralty, Social Security. We are the appellate court for bankruptcy cases. So we do a lot of bankruptcy appellate work. On the criminal side, it's a varied docket as well. Everything from bank robberies to Medicaid fraud to foreign corrupt practices, which generally involves oil company executives bribing people, drug cases, bank robberies, and tax fraud, mortgage fraud, all number of different types of criminal matters. A lot of immigration, but on the immigration side, it's not determining whether or not somebody should be here. It's the criminal aspect of immigration, which is illegal reentry after deportation. So a huge part of the docket of the judges in the Southern District of Texas involves immigration matters, immigration cases. So we have a really varied docket. And because of that, a question about how we approach a case is probably way too generalized, because in patent cases, we look at what the issues are in terms of what the claims are that are in dispute. And we have to analyze what the claims of the patent meant before we can even get to trying to decide the case on the merit. In employment discrimination cases, very often we're looking at whether or not it should be done as a class action or if it should be done as an individual cause of action. In admiralty cases, we're often looking at whether or not it actually fits under maritime law and whether or not it should be a matter that should be addressed and dealt with in federal court as opposed to state court. In personal injury cases, often we're looking at whether or not the amount in controversy is sufficient for it to be in federal court, or if the amount in controversy is such that it should be in state court. So every case you sort of approach differently depending on the kind of issue that you're dealing with. In criminal cases, we have a really high plea rate here. About 95% of our cases actually plead and don't go to trial. And so mostly in criminal cases, we're just really analyzing and looking at the people's background, history, characteristics, their previous criminal history to determine what their sentence should be given the guidelines that we're asked to consider. We're not strictly bound by the guidelines anymore like we used to be, but we take all those factors into consideration in determining how the sentence should be imposed and what kind of sentence we should impose. So every case that you get presents a different challenge, a different opportunity to learn, to research, and to work. So it literally just depends on the kind of case that you're dealing with on any given day. And on any given day, you might look at 10 different issues. You may start the day, and this morning I started my day looking at my sentencings for next week. So on Tuesday of next week, I have a whole bunch of different cases that I'm sentencing. Some of them are immigration cases, and so those are pretty cut and dry. One is a huge Medicare fraud case involving a $16 million fraudulent claim against Medicare. And so I'm looking at issues involving what the actual loss amount was, because you sentence based on the actual loss amount. So those are some issues. And then another one, the next case is somebody who made a false claim to get a firearm. So every single case that you look at is going to be completely different. Then later on today, I'll be dealing with Fair Labor Standards Act issue, somebody who felt like they weren't being paid fairly by their employer. In the context of the employment, which we have a large number of those cases that we have to deal with here. So I have to look at some of those issues, and then I may end up ending the day doing a temporary restraining order. Somebody who feels that they are being mistreated by someone, and they want the court to enjoin some conduct. So every single day you have the opportunity to look at a variety of different matters, from criminal to civil to admiralty, bankruptcy, patent infringement, all kinds of intellectual property issues. So it's definitely not a job that you're going to get bored in at all. I mean, at all.
And I can see now just how complex the simple question I thought I was asking actually was. So on the civil side, primarily, is where you see a lot of legal writing, I presume.
Yes, much more on the civil side than on the criminal side. We don't get that much in the way of briefing on the criminal cases that we have here, because like I indicated to you, most of them plead out. So we just don't have that many opportunities to do much legal writing on the criminal side.
Okay. And in your many years here on the bench, I'm sure you've seen some good legal writing and I'm sure you've seen some bad legal writing. So what distinguishes the two for you?
One, don't lie to the judge. Act like we're going to actually read all of the cases that you cite to us. Do not misquote cases or pull out the piece that you want out of a case or take it out of context or cite to me a case that's already been overruled or cite to me a case that's not a controlling case as if somehow or another that's going to influence the court's decision. I think that's one of my pet peeves when people cite cases that are not controlling authority for this court in this circuit in any way and hoping that you'll just go with what somebody else said when it doesn't really have that much, really doesn't matter that much in terms of what the law is in this particular circuit. So cite controlling authority, don't misquote cases, don't cherry pick information out of a case to make it look that like it's a case that supports your legal theory. Because we're actually going to read the cases. We're actually going to look at it. And so we need accurate information. And once you start doing things that are purposely or look like they're purposely designed to mislead the court, it taints the way that we look at the work that you give us.
Thank you for that advice. I'm sure a lot of our listeners who are still in law school and probably early in practice will be able to employ that. Let's go back now for a moment to sentencing and criminal cases. So you've spoken frequently about implicit bias, and last year you gave a Sondok Jurist in Residence lecture at the University of Houston Law Center about the legacy of Booker and how federal sentencing guidelines, when they became discretionary, sort of exacerbated some of the racial disparities that we see in criminal sentencing. Can you speak a little bit about that?
Yeah, I sort of got dragged into that unwittingly. The federal judges, every year we attend different, basically continuing education courses for our judges to make sure that we're up to date on the latest Supreme Court law and to drill down on some areas of law that we might have a particular interest in. If you have a lot of employment discrimination cases, you might get to drill down on some issues in that area. If you have a lot of intellectual property, you might do that. So in any event, in one of these workshops that I was at one year, there was some discussion about the way that we deal with sentencing in criminal cases. And I brought up the fact that myself and some of my colleagues here had all been very involved in handling the Enron litigation, criminal cases related to the fall of the Enron Corporation, and that one of my colleagues had sentenced one of the Enron defendants, but gave him a lighter sentence because he said that he was a leader in the Boy Scouts and that he didn't need a tougher sentence because he had already been embarrassed in his community by getting convicted of this crime. So when I read that article in the newspaper, I did not take it at face value because we are often misquoted in the newspaper. And so I went to my colleague and I said, I read this information about this case and it didn't seem quite like you would say something like this. And he said, no, Vanessa, you don't understand. You know, those other defendants, you know, in their communities, nobody cares about them going to jail. They're not even embarrassed about being criminals because everybody in their community is a criminal. And in these people, they're in an upstanding community. And when they go to jail, the embarrassment is enough. And I said, wait, that's like worse than the way it was in the newspaper. And I think, and this colleague I adore, in fact, if I was going to try to fake and put my picture on something as a federal judge, I'd use his picture. He's like the quintessential looking federal judge. But I think that he didn't even understand his implicit bias, that he was automatically biased towards people who came from communities where maybe there weren't as many people going to jail and that they should get less time than other people because nobody cares in their communities if they go to jail or not, which in the other people he was referring to were primarily people of color. And so trying to explain to him the fallacy in his analysis and his thought process was just so frustrating to me. And so I was discussing this with my colleagues in the course that we were attending. And so the next year, I was actually asked to come out and be a presenter at our national workshop. But they wanted me to present on the issue of recidivism and the work that I was doing with my coloring book for the children of the incarcerated and how we were using it to address recidivism issues. So I went to California under the false pretense that I was giving a speech on recidivism and the use of and tools that we had developed to address some of those issues. And when I got there, they said, oh, by the way, here's our bait and switch on you. We've just finished our big national study on sentencing disparities. It's not been published yet. Nobody's seen it yet. Here's a copy. It shows all the sentencing disparities that happen as a result of judges being freed from the sentencing guidelines and now being free to sentence using their own judgment and discretion. And by the way, it shows that Black defendants are getting a sentence that's about 25% higher than white defendants, and that they're 16% less likely to get a non-guideline downward departure than white defendants. And we want you to present this study to your colleagues at the conference. So I had to stay up all night, write a completely different speech, and get up and give that presentation and that speech to my colleagues the next day. And I thought, how in the world did I get roped into this? I was like, oh, I get it. Yeah. Make the Black girl tell her colleagues that they're biased. And they were like, I said, I'll see how it is. And they were like, yeah, that's how it is. You need to go and do this. And so I took on the challenge and I developed in a very short amount of time, what I thought was a very good speech, not accusatory, but just enlightening. I think that so much of the time, people don't even understand what their implicit biases are and how they're looking at things in a biased way. And so I think that the reason that I was chosen or asked to participate is because I think that the people from the Federal Judicial Center believe that, one, it's easier to hear something like that from a colleague, and two, that I had the kind of personality that would lend itself to helping my colleagues understand what was happening without making it sound like I was saying, you're racist, because that's not what I was really trying to get across. The point is, implicit bias is unconscious bias. It's bias that's based on your background, your history, your observations of things that are based on the way that you know, you've experienced things in life. And implicit and unconscious is the same thing. It's not literal racism. It's not literal bias. It's like, what unconscious things are you dealing with that are causing you to look at it in a way that skews your thinking such that you believe that people of color should get more time because everybody in their community is in jail? And so it was very well received. I was really nervous about it, but afterwards I had colleagues just running up to me, just saying, you know, how can I make sure I'm not doing this? And if I do this, do you think that that's like unconscious bias? And it actually turned me on to a film that had been developed by the United States District Court in Seattle, Washington. They have a whole film, a movie that they do on implicit bias that they show to every jury panel in criminal cases before the jurors are seated, and they developed a whole set of jury instructions on implicit bias that now I've incorporated into the instructions that I use in cases. So it really was very enlightening for me, and it was very positive, and it was very favorably received. And I hope that it just opened some of my colleagues' eyes into the idea that they may be guilty of an implicit or unconscious bias and just really not know it. And so I thought that it was a very good experience. And so since then, I've given actually several speeches on implicit bias for the State Bar of Texas, for the Houston Bar Association, at the University of Houston, as I've continued to do research in that area and find out some of the work that other people are doing to try to address issues of implicit bias in not just in sentencing, but in jury selection and just the way that we handle our cases in general.
Sounds like it had a really great direct effect at the conference, and that people that you've been talking to are becoming more and more aware of it. And mm-hmm. without becoming aware of it, you can't start to think critically about your own habits and tendencies and things. So I think that's really important work, and I can say that personally, I really appreciate you doing that. Mm-hmm. And I think on behalf of the University of Houston, we love that you came and spread that message to us as well.
It was really, really a great opportunity. And I was very grateful for the opportunity to speak on that issue at the University of Houston.
All right. So you've given a lot of you've spoken at a lot of events and conferences and things like that, but you've also written quite extensively. You have a nice catalog.
Outside of the law.
Outside of the law, yes. All right. You've written extensively inside the law and outside the law. But I thought we could go through a few of your books and kind of talk about them and what inspired them. That you'd mentioned just now the coloring book that you had written for children of incarcerated parents. And that book is called A Boy Named Rocky. So all of you can go buy a copy if you're listening to this.
So the genesis for that was... I speak a lot, and I was asked to speak to a group of young ladies at a middle school, and it was a big celebration. I don't even know the name of it, but it was a big group of kids, maybe 300-400 kids. And then at the end of that ceremony or that event, I was asked to speak separately to a smaller group of students. In the library. But the way that they went about it was just so all wrong. They got on the loudspeaker and started saying the names of the girls that needed to be to report to the to the library to meet with me. You know, Jennifer Smith, go to the library. And, you know, Diana Jones, go to the library. Ella Lee, go to the library. So it didn't take the audience very long to recognize that the girls that they were calling out to go to the library to meet with the judge were all the girls that were sort of been designated as the bad girls in school. So I was like, oh, this is going to be fun. So I get to the library and I go in there and there's like this group of like mad, pissed off looking little young ladies, young girls, because they've been called all out publicly. And they know, they look around and they see, oh, we're the people that are designated the bad kids. So I'm supposed to talk to them about not being bad. But I could tell this was just going south immediately. So I say to the lady who had invited me, Mrs. Jones, I said, young ladies, we're going to have a conversation in here today. I said, but it's going to be a private conversation. And I said, so we don't need Miss Jones in our business, do we? They were like, oh, the judge, she put Miss Jones out. So that, you know, set a better tone. So I asked Miss Jones to leave. And I said, because what happens in this room is going to stay in this room. And the first question that I asked them was how many of them, because one of my friend who was the co-author of the book with me, she'd asked me, how many people that you send to prison have children? I said, I don't know. We don't keep track of that. We don't keep any statistical information on that. But I guess 95% of them probably have kids. Everybody has kids. And so she says, y'all should keep track of that, of how many people have children. So I started doing it on my own. Well, everybody has kids. And we talked about it from the standpoint of how the incarceration of a parent impacts the child. Because when you lose a parent to incarceration, it feels the same as losing a parent to death. Except that people don't rally around you the same way. You know, when you lose a parent to death, everybody rallies around you and tells you, oh, your dad was a good person. And, oh, you know, you don't even know if you're still even talking about the same person by the time you hear all the stuff, good stuff they say at a funeral. But when you lose a parent to incarceration, they say, oh, your dad was no good. You're probably going to be just like him. And the reality is 75% of kids who have an incarcerated parent end up incarcerated themselves. Whatever they see is what they believe that their reality is supposed to be. And so when I asked those young ladies, how many of you all have parents that are incarcerated? Well, almost everybody in the entire room. And it makes kids act out. So when kids get depressed, they don't do what we do as adults, you know, go drink or get in the bed or just be in a foul mood. They act out aggressively. They act out in school. And so these are the kids that were the depressed kids. They were the kids whose parents were taken away from them. They did not have the same support system that they had before. They lost a parent to incarceration. And so they start doing things at school that get them in trouble and get them labeled. And so my friend, who I wrote the book with, is a child psychologist. We decided to write this book to specifically help children of the incarcerated deal with some of the challenges and issues that they face as a result of losing a parent to incarceration. And we started speaking extensively on that issue to different churches and organizations, Big Brothers Big Sisters. We did a whole Train the Trainer program for Big Brothers Big Sisters. Another big organization here that addresses that issue is an organization called Change Happens. We did some Train the Trainer work with them. And so we did a lot to try to, one, just educate people on trying to address the needs that these children have and trying to hold the parents responsible for still parenting, even if they are incarcerated, because the children aren't mad at the parent for what they did. They still love their parents, and so their parents still have an opportunity to be a good influence, even if the influence is, don't end up here where I ended up in jail, because this isn't where you want to be. And so it gives the parents an opportunity to make amends to the children for leaving them behind, essentially, and it also gives them an opportunity to parent by explaining to them that they made poor choices and that their children do not have to make the same poor choices that they made. And so I ended up deciding later, I was able later, through the help of the probation department, to use that book in a program that we do here in the courthouse. About once a quarter, we bring in all of the people that have been indicted but not yet convicted, and we talk to them about the services and the things that we can provide for them to help them as they transition, probably, to prison. Job opportunities, help with drug addiction or abuse. But the other thing that they brought me in to start talking to them about was how we can help them and their children during this transition. Because as depressed as they might be about the prospect of going off to jail, the children are even more upset and depressed about it. But they're too wrapped up in their own, you know, grief about it happening that a lot of times the children just don't get their needs, particularly their serious mental health needs, addressed. So we use the book as a means of allowing them to allow us to help them and their families as they go through this transition. So as a result of that, I was able to find out that many of them had a lot of legal issues that were not really criminal legal issues. They were things like guardianships and landlord and tenant and making sure the driver's license and Social Security was in place and making sure that things were in place to make the transition easier for their children after they left. So I talked the dean of the law school at Texas Southern University into starting a little clinic over there called the U.S. Pretrial Legal Clinic to help our people with the non-criminal legal issues that they had, which would actually make the transition easier for them and their families as they were taken into incarceration. A lot of them was just guardianship stuff, landlord and tenant type things, estate type things, you know, making sure there was money in place, Social Security, different things like that. So that actually ended up being a very positive thing that came out of that whole use of the book. And so when you start talking to people and showing them, look, we can help, we can't keep you from going to jail, but we can help your children not go to jail, then people sit up and they want to listen, because no one wants their children to follow them into jail. Everybody wants their kids to be a chip off the old block, but not if the old block is going to a cell block, you know. But I, in the context of speaking a lot on this issue, I remember I was on a radio show one morning and a guy called in who said that he met his father and his grandfather for the first time in prison. All three generations of the men in their family were all incarcerated. So whatever, you know, what the sins of the father or visit on the son and then visit on the grandson. But if that's what you see, that's what you do. And so you have to give them an opportunity to show their children that there is a different way, that there's a better way. But sometimes it's just about really helping them be set up and not just dropped in the grease when the parents leave, and making sure that things are in place for the kids, for them to continue on with their life, even though they're going to still deal with some of the grief and some of the depression, but you can alleviate some of the problems that they might be having.
Well, that's really incredible, and I think it's a great example of mm-hmm. taking more of a holistic approach to your role as a judge, not just within the courtroom, but thinking about consequences that affect more people than just the criminal defendant, and also thinking about ways to mitigate potential influences on younger people in the community.
And actually, you know, selfishly, there's another reason that it helped, that we do this kind of work. If you help a person who's incarcerated stay connected to their family during their period of incarceration, it cuts down on recidivism. Mm-hmm. They're less likely to reoffend if they have a family to go back to. And so if you facilitate some means of their being able to stay in a good relationship, in a good space with their family, then that means when they come out, they have someplace to go. And so it helps us from the standpoint of people not reoffending.
All right, let's talk about your book, Saving the Dream. This book, from your website, says it tells the story of a young woman and her decision of whether to have her baby or give it up for adoption. And can you explain what was the impetus for writing this book?
It was actually whether to keep her baby herself or to give her baby up for adoption. Oh. So those were her choices, whether she was going to choose to parent herself or whether or not she would make the ultimate sacrifice that a mother might make and surrender her child to somebody else to raise. And so the motivation or the impetus for that book was that I have an adopted son. And at the time that I adopted my son, a publisher from Doubleday approached me about writing a book about adoption. And so I thought she meant a nonfiction book about adoption, which I tried to start writing. But then I realized I don't know anything about adoption. I only know something about my own adoption, which that's not very helpful. And so I just could not get into it. And so what ended up happening was as my son started growing up, I realized and thought a lot about how different his life was than the life he might have lived if he had been raised by his birth mother. And so I started thinking about all of the things that were different or how different those things would have been and realized that there was a story there, but I didn't want to really tell his story because his story is his story to tell. So I just decided that I would write a fiction novel that was sort of a sliding doors book between the two worlds that might have been. What might it have been like if a child was raised with their birth mother versus the life that they might have lived growing up with the woman that I called his earth mother, the mother that was divinely chosen for him by adoption, a kind of going back and forth between the two worlds that might have been. So that was my motivation, and that was sort of the theory and the theme of the book. But I didn't want to write a book that just was like, if you get adopted by a good family, your life's great, and if you don't, it's not, because that's not a book. Who the heck wants to read that?
Right.
It's just a book about the challenges that parents face raising a child in any circumstances, whether it's deemed to be good circumstances or more affluent household, or whether it's deemed to be one that is not. Either way, there's always challenges, and if you don't know, then you need to start trying to raise a kid, because there's no easy way to do it. It's a lot of work, and so it just really explores the differences in terms of the challenges that different families face and the joys that different families have. And it was written really as a way to encourage families and other single people to pursue their own dreams of parenting through adoption, because I think that a lot of people, you know, sometimes are nervous about the whole idea or the issue of adoption. And I think that by writing the book, I sort of shifted the paradigm for a lot of people within my friend group. And a lot of my friends started adopting after that and coming to me for adoption advice. I don't think that I was any better at giving adoption advice than anybody else. I didn't know that much about adoption. But I could talk about my experiences and the joys that I believe that I was able to have as a result of starting my family through adoption. And so it really was a good opportunity for me to open the door to have those discussions with just any number of people, and something that I was really very passionate about. So yeah, that's Saving the Dream. That's what Saving the Dream was about.
That sounds mm-hmm. great. Mm-hmm. So we don't have too much time left here today, but I thought maybe we could talk about some of the activities that you're involved with outside of being a judge. If there are maybe one or two that you'd like to highlight here.
Okay, so I'd like to play golf. Anybody wants to play golf, please call me to play golf. I'm a golfer.
That sounds good.
And I used my joy of golf as a means of just one of the community activities I became involved in recent years. I joined the board of First Tee of Houston, which is an organization to expose children that might not otherwise have the opportunity to play golf, but to expose them to the game of golf. So I've spent some years on the board of the First Tee of Houston, which I absolutely loved. I've rolled off of that board. I spent 17 years on the board of my undergraduate college, Hampton University in Hampton, Virginia, which is where my son is actually attending college now.
Oh, that's cool.
And so I did a lot of work for Hampton on academic affairs issues for a number of years. I spent a few years on the board of the River Oaks Baptist School, which is the school that my son attended through middle school, working on issues involving risk management and some of the financial issues that we were dealing with at the school. And currently I'm on the board of the Texas Children's Hospital and also on the board of DePelchin Children's Center. Specifically, I'm on DePelchin's board because one, I adopted my son from there, and two, I'm interested on issues in issues involving children aging out of the foster care system, and I'm hoping to be able to work on some of those issues in my role as a board member at DePelchin Children's Center.
Judge Gilmore, it seems like you don't ever kind of casually engage with the subject. It's like once you're involved with something, you really dig into it, and multifaceted approaches, and that's really inspiring. So that's a great example to set for all of us.
Well, I have fun, I think that to the extent that, you know, we all have a limited amount of time, I think that you should pick things that you love, that you're passionate about, that you enjoy doing, because you'll just do a better job. If you like children, then you should be involved with organizations that work to the benefit of children. If you like golf, then you should be involved in organizations that promote the sport of golf, not just for people who can afford to play it, but for people who maybe can't afford to play it and aren't able to access golf courses as easily as some of the rest of us are. So I think that you can, you know, combine the things that you love always with an opportunity to work in the community and to help other people, because there are just a number of opportunities out there for you to combine your time and your talent and your experience with things that you really enjoy.
All right, Judge, you're a distinguished alumna of the University of Houston. You're a trailblazer, and you're a great inspiration for many of us at the Law Center and beyond. So from the Houston Law Review and on behalf of our podcast, thank you so much for speaking with me today and for your example that you lead for
all
us.
Right. Well, thank you for having me.
All right. Emphasis Added is a podcast by the Houston Law Review. Production is possible because of generous support from the Houston Law Review Alumni Association and from Vinson & Elkins. If you have thoughts on today's episode or suggestions for a future episode, email me at eic@houstonlawreview.org. Be sure to follow the Houston Law Review on Twitter and Instagram at HoustonLRev. That's Houston, L-R-E-V. Or find us on Facebook under the name Houston Law Review.